Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
We begin with a story related to North Korea. Mario Ritter reports on how North Korea's rocket launch on Sunday may have strengthened the country's leader.
North Korea's rocket launch on Sunday and the international criticism of its nuclear test last month may have strengthened its leader, Kim Jong-un. North Korea's state media regularly report that Kim's actions defend the country against hostile American and South Korean forces. Reports in the North say the rocket launch showed the country is increasing its technological knowledge. The U.S. Joint Space Operations Center said the rocket launch placed two objects in Earth orbit. But it is not known if either of the objects is operating. North Korea launched a satellite in 2012. It orbits the Earth every 95 minutes. North Korea says the satellite has cameras that can send images to Earth, but no signal has ever been heard from it. On Sunday, the United Nations Security Council condemned North Korea for testing ballistic missile technology. The Council rejected North Korea's claim that it was launching a satellite. It said the rocket launch was designed to help in the development of nuclear weapon delivery systems. The Council has approved resolutions banning North Korea from developing nuclear weapons and ballistic missile technology. Since 2006, it has approved four resolutions placing economic and political sanctions on North Korea. Experts say the recent rocket launch and nuclear test send a clear message to the world that North Korea will not end its nuclear program. They say North Korea's ruling Kim family was influenced by the removal of Muammar Gaddafi as ruler of Libya in 2011. In 2003, Gaddafi had promised to end his country's nuclear program. Experts say this has caused the North's rulers to increase their support for nuclear weapons tests. Daniel Pinkston teaches international relations at Troy University in Seoul. He says he does not believe any kind of sanctions or anything else other than force or some internal revolutionary change in North Korea would get them off this track. It's part of their identity. I'm Mario Ritter.
After a week-long attack from Russian warplanes, some Syrian rebels are withdrawing from the fight in northern Syria. The rebels are fighting against forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Some anti-Assad forces have taken shelter in tunnels or bomb-made craters, but some fighters are quitting. Ahmad is a 20-year-old rebel fighter. He made the decision to withdraw from the fighting. He told VOA about the battles near Aleppo in northern Syria. The first day, the fight, it was easy, he said. After that, The second days and the third, it was very difficult. We lost a lot of people, a lot of friends, a lot of fighters. On the fourth day of fighting, Russian warplanes bombed everything in the area. Ahmad said he could feel and hear the force of the Russian bombs. About 100 fighters withdrew from the battles. Ahmad said they withdrew because they felt betrayed. He said friends of Syria, like the United States, Western countries, and other Gulf nations, betrayed the fighters. He also blamed the Free Syrian Army rebels and other Islamist brigades for not joining forces to defeat the Assad government's forces. It might be too late, he said. The civil war in Syria will enter its fifth year this March.
Next, we bring you a story on how United States President Barack Obama is asking the U.S. Congress for funding to help fight the Zika virus. The funds would go to research and other services to combat the disease. Mary Gottschall has more.
President Barack Obama is asking Congress for more than $1.8 billion to fight the Zika virus in the United States and other countries. The White House said Monday that most of the money would be spent in the United States on programs to combat the virus, which is spread by mosquitoes. These initiatives include mosquito control programs, vaccine research, and healthcare services for low-income pregnant women. President Barack Obama urged calm in an interview that aired on Monday. The good news is this is not like Ebola. People don't die of Zika. A lot of people get it and don't even know they have it, he told CBS News. But there shouldn't be panic on this. This is not something where people are going to die from it. It is something we have to take seriously. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is the top federal public health agency. It has reported 50 cases of Zika among U.S. travelers from December 2015 to February 2016. In the latest outbreak, Brazil reported the first case of Zika virus in May 2015. The Pan American Health Organization said 26 countries and territories in the Americas have reported cases of the virus since. Last week, the World Health Organization declared Zika a global health emergency. The Global Health Organization also predicts that Zika could infect as many as 4 million people in the Americas this year. Zika causes no symptoms in 80% of people who are infected, and only mild symptoms in people who fall ill. Scientists believe it can cause microcephaly, a birth defect that causes babies to have abnormally small heads and problems with learning. U.S. health officials said their greatest concern is for pregnant women who develop Zika. The Zika virus is a disease transmitted by Aedes mosquitoes. There is no specific treatment or vaccine currently available, but drug companies in India, Japan, and France announced that they are working to develop possible vaccines. I'm Mary Gottschall.
A powerful earthquake struck Taiwan on Saturday. Now, officials say a woman and her 2-year-old son were found Monday morning. Here again is Mario Ritter.
2 people have been rescued from a collapsed 17-story apartment building in Tainan, Taiwan, where a powerful earthquake struck Saturday. Officials say a woman was found under the body of her husband Monday morning. The body of their 2-year-old son was found near them. Rescue workers are searching for 5 other members of the woman's family. A man was also found alive. He is reported to be talking to rescue workers. The powerful earthquake of magnitude 6.4 struck early Saturday morning. At least 36 people have died. Liu Shicheng is the Deputy Secretary General of the City of Tainan government. He told VOA that more than 300 people have been rescued from the building. He says about 100 people are missing. 16 rescue teams from across the country are helping search for survivors. Liu says workers are now entering into the most difficult part of the rescue effort. That is because most people must be found within 72 hours after being trapped. Workers are using cranes, tools, and their hands to dig through collapsed buildings. Medical workers are ready to help anyone found alive. Taiwan's official central news agency says 9 buildings were destroyed in the quake, all of them in the historic city of Tainan. Many other buildings are unsafe, forcing people who lived or worked in them to leave. Markets, banks, and other companies that operated in the buildings are closed. Liu says hotels will let people stay in rooms without charge for a week. Taiwan's Central Weather Bureau said there have been several smaller quakes since Saturday. The quake struck 2 days before the Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations, the most important holiday in the Chinese calendar. I'm Mario Ritter.
The Denver Broncos football team won America's biggest sports championship on Sunday night. The Broncos won the National Football League championship game, known as the Super Bowl. Dan Friedel tells us more about the game and other performances that evening.
Football is the most popular professional sport in the United States. The National Football League, NFL, championship is called the Super Bowl. The game is always played on a Sunday, and that day is called Super Bowl Sunday. It is such a big day, it is almost like a holiday for some people. People throw big parties to celebrate, and then gather around large televisions to watch the game. This year, the Denver Broncos football team defeated the Carolina Panthers 24-10 to win the championship. Before the game, most people thought Carolina, the team based in the North Carolina city of Charlotte, would win. So the final score is what people call an upset. About 70,000 people watched the game in person at Levi's Stadium in California. And over 100 million people in the U.S. alone watched the game on television. But Super Bowl Sunday is not only about what happens on the football field. Some like to watch the TV commercials for car companies, beer manufacturers, and internet sites. Many others are more interested in the entertainment than the game itself. Before the game started, Lady Gaga sang the national anthem. But all people could talk about was her sparkling red suit and red, white, and blue platform high heel shoes. She even had glittery red eye makeup. Most people agreed she did a good job with a difficult song. There is always a short concert by a popular music group or singer at halftime of the game. This year, the main performer was the British band Coldplay. Coldplay performed its hit songs Viva La Vida, Paradise, and Adventure of a Lifetime. Coldplay decorated the stage with colorful flowers and displayed rivers of color on the stage using projectors and video boards. After three songs, Bruno Mars took the stage to perform Uptown Funk, one of his most popular songs. But singer Beyoncé stole the show with her performance. Beyoncé and her backup dancers took the field wearing military-inspired jackets to perform her new song, Formation. The song talks about police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement. It was released the day before the Super Bowl. As for the jackets and the berets worn by her dancers, many compared them to those worn by the Black Panthers, a 1960s radical group that advocated Black power. I'm Dan Friedel.
This is What's Trending Today. The Republican debate Saturday night in New Hampshire was one last chance for presidential candidates to appeal to voters ahead of the state's primary vote on February 9th. But before the debate even began, something funny happened, and people are still talking about it today. ABC News showed the debate live on television. At the beginning of the broadcast, the debate announcers called each candidate's name. The candidates were to walk out on stage one by one. First, they announced New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He walked out onto the debate stage. Next, they announced Ben Carson. Dr. Carson took a few steps and then he stopped. He did not come out on stage when his name was called. A worker for ABC News backstage told Carson, "Go, go, go." But Dr. Carson continued to wait in the hallway that led to the stage. Next, the announcers introduced Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Cruz had a funny look on his face and walked right past Dr. Carson onto the stage. Then they introduced businessman Donald Trump, but he did not come out onto the stage either. So for a few minutes, the camera showed Carson and Trump standing together in the hallway. The rest of the candidates looked confused as they walked past them onto the stage. The announcers did not know what to do either. The TV comedy show Saturday Night Live made a joke about the incident just a few hours later. One of the show's comedians joked, "Here is actual footage of Ben Carson's entrance, where the one thing he forgot to do was enter." On social media, people posted about the debate's confusing beginning. Many people wondered what happened. One Twitter user posted, "I never thought watching seven people walk onto a stage would be so funny." And that's What's Trending Today. I'm Ashley Thompson.
B The Obama administration has made it easier for Americans to visit Cuba. On the streets of Havana, American flags, cell phones, and private restaurants point to a new era of openness. But will a flood of American visitors hurt Cuba's unique culture? Adam Brock and Ann Ball report.
Time seems to stand still in Havana, Cuba's capital city. Old men in fedoras smoke cigars and play dominoes. Colorful American cars from the 1950s share the road with rusty bicycles. Laundry hangs from the balconies of crumbling mansions. Children who have never used the internet play soccer on cobblestone streets. The sound of traditional Cuban music drifts from a corner cafe. This is the Havana that American tourists dream of. Romantic, mysterious, and forbidden.
American citizens cannot legally travel to Cuba as tourists. The tourism ban goes back to the early 1960s, when tensions between the U.S. and Cuba were high. Cuba's communist government had formed a close relationship with Russia, formerly known as the Soviet Union. In 1962, the Soviet Union placed nuclear missile silos in Cuba. For 13 tense days, it looked like the U.S. and the Soviet Union would go to war over the missiles in Cuba. Fortunately, the countries reached a diplomatic solution. The event is known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. It is the closest the world has come to a thermonuclear war. The tourism ban is part of a trade embargo on Cuba started by President John F. Kennedy. The ban on trade was an effort to isolate Cuba's communist government.
One legacy of the embargo is the large number of old American cars on the streets of Cuba. After 1961, Cubans could no longer import American cars. Some of these pre-revolutionary cars have more than a million miles on them, or about 1.6 million kilometers. Cubans show incredible creativity in keeping these old cars running. Raul, who only gave his first name, is a taxi driver in Havana.
This car is a 1953 Chevrolet. It is the only one in the family. It came from my grandfather to my father and then to me. Except for the transmission, everything else is original.
The Kennedy-era embargo is still in effect. Over the past year, the Obama administration has eased some parts of the embargo. Relations between the U.S. and Cuba have improved. The U.S. Embassy in Cuba reopened after 54 years, and Cuba has reopened its embassy in Washington, D.C. Americans can now legally travel to Cuba for 12 different types of people-to-people exchanges. However, a trip to an all-inclusive beach resort is still illegal under American law. Kate Burrell lives in New York City. In January, she visited Cuba with Friendly Planet, an educational tour company.
What surprised me was that it was really as beautiful as all of those cliched photos that you see in like travel brochures. Lots of beautiful old cars, and the buildings in the old town were gorgeous.
But it can be difficult for Americans to meet with ordinary Cubans on organized tours.
The main drawback was that I didn't spend any time with the locals. I only got to interact with the tour guides.
Scenes of a more open Cuba can be seen on the streets of Havana. The American flag is a common sight, on t-shirts, hanging from balconies, flying on top of taxis. Such displays seemed impossible just a few years ago. In the winter, waves from the Caribbean crash over Havana's seawall, flooding the Malecón. The Malecón is a famous road that runs along Havana's north coast. Every day at sunset, thousands of Cubans gather here to chat, fish, swim, and play music. These days, you can see young people on the Malecón with smartphones using wireless internet. Until last summer, the internet was only available in a few universities and luxury hotels. Access to the wireless zone costs about $3 an hour. That is a lot of money in a place where the average state salary is around $25 per month. There are now about 30 public wireless hotspots in Havana. Slowly but surely, Cubans are connecting online.
Young Cubans are eager to learn English, but there are not enough qualified English teachers on the island. Some of the best English teachers go to work in tourism and private restaurants where they can make more money. English also allows Cubans to make friends and contacts outside of the Spanish-speaking world. Juan Carlos Dominguez is the head of the English department of a medical school in Havana. He says Cubans prefer to learn American English.
We are neighbors, very close, 90 miles away only. We have some kind of identification. You can see on the street, on the cars, people on the street with American flags. We respect that.
The number of Americans visiting Cuba has risen sharply in the past year. Havana no longer has enough hotel rooms to keep up with demand. The government now allows Cubans to rent their homes to travelers. Recent developments will send even more Americans to Cuba. Americans no longer have to apply for a license from the U.S. government before coming to Cuba. Regular commercial flights from the United States are expected to start this year. Some people are worried that a flood of American tourists will hurt Cuba's unique culture. They worry that Old Havana will become like a Disney theme park. Will Cuba remain one of the few places in the world without a Starbucks or McDonald's? Juan Carlos Dominguez is not worried about American tourism. He says Cubans have a strong sense of cultural identity, or cubanismo.
If Americans are permitted to come to Cuba as tourists, it could be great. We are going to share with you what we have. The future is bright.
The upcoming U.S. presidential election could have a major impact on U.S.-Cuba relations. Democratic candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have said that they support lifting the embargo. Two Republican presidential candidates have family ties to Cuba. Ted Cruz is the son of a Cuban father and an Anglo mother. Marco Rubio was born to Cuban immigrants in Miami. Both candidates have criticized President Barack Obama's move to normalize relations with Cuba. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Adam Brock.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.